Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, your host and the founder of this event. Tonight we'll be continuing this deep exploration of the future of spiritual practice with Dan Millman, athlete, teacher, coach, and author of The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. I'm happy to let you know that our community has been continuing to grow. We now have almost 34,000 sincere and serious participants. This series was conceived to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by deepening our public dialogue about our moment in history from an evolutionary perspective. This series asks the question, how can our spirituality evolve to help us rise to the challenges of our time and to create a cultural context for transition, a sustainable transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet? We've had a series of adventuresome, probing, and enlightening conversations, and tonight I'm honored to be joined by Dan Millman in a dialogue entitled Head in the Clouds, Feet on the Ground. Dan is a former world champion athlete, a university coach, a martial arts instructor, and a college professor. After an intensive 20-year spiritual quest, Dan's teaching found its form as the Peaceful Warrior's Way, which is expressed fully in his books and lectures. His work continues to evolve over time. His 13 books, including The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, have inspired a movie starring Nick Nolte, and there are millions of readers in 29 languages worldwide. Much of his time is devoted to writing and speaking. His keynotes, seminars, and workshops span the generations to influence men and women from all walks of life, including leaders in the fields of health, psychology, education, business, politics, sports, entertainment, and the arts. With his wife, Joy, Dan lives near me here in Northern California. They have three really fantastic grown daughters and two grandsons so far. I've known Dan for 35 years, and I remember him when he wrote The Way of the Peaceful Warrior and launched his career. He even used to teach me trampoline. One of the things I love about Dan is that he is truly trustable. He brings integrity, discipline, clarity, and sincerity to serving others and the greater good. And in my opinion, that's the reason why his work has been so widely influential. So welcome, Dan. I'm really happy to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Terry. After that lovely introduction, I should just say, are there any questions? Well, I'm glad to be here with you and have a chance to share with your listening audience.
Terrific. Well, I want to frame up the kind of the whole context here. You know, I began the spiritual path with the sense that human problems were only going to be able to be solved at a higher level of consciousness than we created those problems. And I entered the path to cultivate that, as I know so many others did. And almost four decades later, I feel like practice really has paid off. I've grown tremendously. I'm happy and alive and awake in ways that I'm deeply grateful for. But I also see an urgency to our world problems that requires a new pace of change. It seems like we're in a unique convergence of crises. And also, we're really clarifying where we are. We're understanding our place in evolution more and more every decade, certainly almost every year. And so I found myself asking very seriously, does spiritual practice itself evolve, and does it need to evolve now or intensify, or somehow can it become a power that can enable us to rise to the challenges of this time? And that's a question I don't think we can offer glib answers to. It may not be one that we can even answer at all, but it's a question I feel compelled to hold and live with like a koan. So that's the context of our interview today, Dan. Is there anything you'd like to say just in general, hearing that?
Well, I'm happy to do so. The response that comes up for me is I think it is important to define our terms. I sometimes draw the analogy. If I'm thinking of a cow and you hear the word cow, you may have a picture of a cow, but the picture that you form may be different from the picture of the cow I formed, even though we share the same word and understand the general meaning. So we have different interpretations. Even the word spirituality, I'm not even sure what that is anymore. I know traditional definitions. You can look it up, or you can wiki it or Google it. But I see spirit everywhere. So maybe that's the whole idea. I don't know that it's separate from daily life, even though many of us identify spirituality with something particularly Eastern and inward. So those are the first thoughts that come up to me. It's a challenging enough for me to deal with the present of spiritual practice and try to contemplate what the future of that might be. So that term spirituality, we begin with that, and since the theme that I'm bringing to the event today is the head in the clouds, feet on the ground, it conveys a kind of idea of balance. You know, remember Ram Dass used to say we can be lost in cosmic bliss but still be responsible for remembering our zip code. So
right.
That idea of balance is important, and maybe a larger context that relates to this idea of spirituality and spiritual practice is I've observed that in the developing world, most of the world, the bulk of humanity, people are impoverished and they're struggling day to day. That's their proper order of business, to survive, to feed themselves and their families. But those of us fortunate enough to be in a relatively wealthy culture, even if we're dealing with financial economic dislocation right now, still many of us have seen our parents reach a certain level of success, material success. They have a car, their own car. They actually have their own house, a place to live, and some discretionary income. And yet they may notice their parents weren't all that happy. And in fact, many of us, baby boomers, we've achieved that, and that level of success or well-being, and we go, yeah, but I'm not happy yet. So there's a point at which some of us become a bit disillusioned or suspicious of the Western solution to happiness, which is achievement, expansive activity, status, and possessions, and all the remnants of success. So when we become suspicious of that, we start seeking. And we look for another way, and we find the East. We discover the East, like Hesse in his book, Journeys to the East. It was a classic. And we go, the answer must lie with detachment from things of the world, things of the ego. And we go, yes, detachment from possessions and status. As Lily Tomlin said, even if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. You know? So we start gravitating toward the East, and we say all the answers lie within introspection, meditation, and that's when we think of spiritual practice. We didn't identify raising a family or going to work every day, whether we feel like it or not, as a spiritual practice. I certainly do, but most people don't. They go, no, spirituality is inside, is contemplations on the chakras and imagining colors and schematas of our whole psyche. That's all introspective spiritual work. Well, I have friends, and you do too, Terry, I know this, who do a lot of meditation. They're very Eastern in their orientation. And they, obviously meditation is an exercise like push-ups. If you do enough push-ups, then you develop more strength. And if you do a lot of meditation, you get some distance from and get more acquainted with the nature of thoughts in the mind. So there are certainly benefits to both. The only difference between the two is you can't pretend to do push-ups. But so my friend meditates a lot. That was sort of a delayed response.
or fool yourself into thinking you're doing push-ups when you're not.
Exactly. And my friend who meditates a lot, you know, he has gained some abilities and some benefits from doing so. But I happen to know him well, and he... His relationships are unstable, you know, his intimate relationships, his finances are not doing well at all because he's not really going out in the Western way of expanding into life and grabbing, you know, the gusto and diving into work and producing an income. He's more interested in just the inner world now. So what I teach, what I call the way of the peaceful warrior, again, head in the clouds, feet on the ground, is more embracing both East and West, the best of those traditions. Flesh and spirit, yin and yang, you know, active and receptive, science and mysticism. So it's an all-encompassing practical way that takes place in daily life as our spiritual practice, a form of spiritual weight training, the adversities we face. So I wanted to give that flavor and that spin to what we're talking about. I'm not really a sophisticated philosopher. You know, my son-in-law is getting his PhD in philosophy, and what he talks about, I don't even get. I mean, it's more, you know, mathematical, precise logic and rules and inner systems of proving things, and it's a whole different world and language. These are real philosophers, not just people who talk about ideas loosely. So I like to define terms, and spirituality is one of those tricky terms like love or happiness that means different things to different people. So that's where I begin when we discuss the future of spiritual practice and some of these higher ideas.
Well, I used that word here, so let me tell you what I meant by it. I find that my most profound inspiration is luminous. It's transcendental. It comes from my intuition of my connection to all of life. It comes out of an open heart, an open head, an open hara, you know, my whole integrated being. And it has been my sense that we're in a moment in time as a human species where we've got to make some pretty rapid changes. And when I imagine where the energy comes from that we can do that, I look at a kind of inspiration that seems beyond the normal range. Something has to enter in, it seems, that would really take us, enable us to come together in a way we haven't yet before. It's like an evolutionary emergence of something new. And it seems like that has to be inspired by another level of awareness and feeling and clarity. And therefore, the word spiritual connects. And in a sense, my own care for the whole has partly come together out of living a life of practice, which is in some ways spiritual and in some ways ordinary. And so I love what you just said. I completely agree. Obviously, we've got to bring our spirituality into life if it's really to mean much. And this is one of the ways in which it seems that it has to come to life maybe in new ways. And, you know, that though, seems like a challenging idea. Is that really going to materialize, or how could it materialize? And in what ways is our spirituality naturally evolving that might be precursors to some kind of a leap?
Personally, I think it's inevitable. I think it's built into our genetics, our humanity. But the time frame is not ours to guess or perhaps force. Some very bad things happen in the world that tend to kick people into a higher level of awareness, or at least we ask bigger questions. It happens in our own personal lives. Something shakes us up, and I'm pointing up right now. For me, it was a shattered right leg in a motorcycle crash, started asking bigger questions, changed the course of my life. However, I don't recommend fractures as a method of spiritual growth. When we face adversity, a dislocation, a divorce, a death in the family, these things can really send us into a deeper level of consideration about our lives. It's not the only way, of course, but I found that I've experimented a lot. Just, you know, grabbing some ice cream and watching television hasn't really done it for me, even though it's quite enjoyable. So often those moments of real depth and profundity that remind us of the ephemeral nature of our lives and those we love, that can be a stimulus. I thought I'd say something that might help clarify and provide a context, though, for our, again, head in the clouds, feet on the ground. And without belaboring that, I've noticed that we exist in two realities. We live in a conventional world. And there is also, as you noted, Terry, I think it's a very important term, the transcendental. When someone's life is very successful, often they'll reach a point where they go, but there's got to be something more. And that something more, I think, is a yearning for the transcendent, for something higher and purer. And I think conventional and transcendental states of mind, if the best way I can put it, have their own truths. And an example I sometimes give in my various seminars is, if I were to suggest to your listening audience and to you that a spider is a bloodthirsty, vicious, merciless killer, you might disagree, unless I added the phrase from the viewpoint of a fly caught in its web. then you might say, oh, well, yeah, from that viewpoint, I can understand that that statement might be true. Now, from your view of mine, most spiders are harmless, little delicate, fragile, you know, aesthetic little web spinners. So which is true? Are they merciless killers, delicate web spinners? Both are true, but it depends on our frame of reference, our point of view. And in the same way, we hear all these things about people who newly discover Eastern spirituality. We hear things like there are no accidents, only lessons, and we are all one, and there is no death. And you know, we've heard all these phrases. And they are all true from a transcendental viewpoint. But from a conventional viewpoint, they are certainly not true. For example, you know, I've spilled things on the dinner table because I wasn't paying attention. I don't know that there was a profound lesson except pay attention. They were seem like accidents from a conventional level, but maybe from a transcendental view, you know, it's all about making mistakes and learning. And the idea that we are all one. Now, that's patently absurd from a conventional viewpoint. It's nice saying, you know, we are all one, lovely idea. But from a conventional view, if I bump my knee and it hurts, you don't feel pain unless you're highly empathic. And if I have a thought or an emotion, you don't necessarily have the same one. So conventionally speaking, we can't deny that we are separate, these bodies, and we have different experiences of life. But yet from a transcendental view, you know, if we sit down to meditate and we go deeper and deeper until we aren't merely aware, we become awareness, you know, we become the witness, and we reach that point of elevated detachment, and we come to realize we are, at our essence, that consciousness or awareness shining through all these billions of eyes, the same consciousness. Some people even call God or spirit. And from that view, we couldn't be anything but one. It would be laughable to think of ourselves as separate from that view. And it's the same with death. Conventionally speaking, death is real. It happens. The body decomposes. We miss people. We don't see them again in the flesh. But from a transcendental view, death is an almost laughable impossibility. Never born, never dies. So I think people seek that way to realize, not just intellectually understand, but to realize through practice, as you say, eventually, maybe enough meditation, maybe enough koan practice, where they begin to realize the higher truth of that transcendental, while appreciating that we still have to live in the conventional world. I hope that wasn't too long a monologue, but that's the round I wanted to set.
Well, that's perfect context, and I guess what I want to lean into then from that place is to ask you. You see the same world developments and circumstances, and probably at times feel the same kinds of concerns that many of us do about the course of human affairs. Do you feel inspired in your heart to try to make a difference in a specific way? Do you have a sense of possibility? Do you have a sense that the kind of work you've devoted yourself to, which really does have to do with helping people wake up to a sane and self-responsible participation in life, and then the consciousness behind it, that can have a larger impact on human affairs?
Well, I think it works both ways. Human affairs, our environment, we're part of it, we're influenced by it, which can sow the seeds of our awakening, and sometimes some unlikely ways, difficulties and so on, cause us to go deeper, as I mentioned. But at the same time, the work we do on ourselves can make a huge difference. I guess there's a story that might indicate that. You know, many people are more social activists. They're involved, and they totally believe fully in the conventional world, and that's it. What you see is what you get. So they feel compelled to change things and improve our environment and our politics so that we can make this better world, because it's all we've got. There are other people who are totally detached rather than associated. They're more dissociated. They go, it's all an illusion. It's Maya, you know, and I'll just sit and meditate and let the world do its dramas around me. But again, there is that balance where we can live, you know, as the old cliche goes, we can live in the world but not of the world. Life is a game we play as if it matters. So we do play the game, and we do play it as if it matters, but we recognize a certain level of drama and just this great theater of life. So work on ourselves can certainly help that. I tell the story about one day I was doing a lot of work on myself. This was during a period of time back in the late 60s. In my book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, the old man I describe as Socrates, you know, as you said, played by Nick Nolte in the movie. And we were walking down the street in Berkeley, and this was a time I was doing deep self-massage based on the Mongolian warriors to clear fear-produced tension from every bone surface of the body, and a lot of self-analysis, self-reflection, meditation, inner work. And as we were walking down Telegraph Avenue, we saw a poster on the wall about starving children, and another about oppressed peoples, and so many things needed help in correcting. And I turned to Socrates, and I said, you know, Soc, I feel kind of selfish and guilty or something, doing all this work on myself. Some people call it navel-gazing, you know, and I said, how can I do this when so many people are in need out there? And he turned to me, and this I actually got this little bit of a scene into the movie at the last minute. He turned to me and said, take a swing at me. I'll give you $5 if you can slap me on the cheek. And I said, what? Did you hear what I was just saying? He said, come on. So I figured it was some kind of test. So I was bobbing and weaving, and I finally took a swing, tried to slap him on the cheek, and I found myself on the ground, a rather painful wrist hold, and as he led me up to my feet, he said, notice a little leverage can be very effective. And I said, yeah, I noticed. And he said, well, you know, you want to help people, that's great. You know, of course, do what you can, do what you're moved to do. That's what we're here for. But don't neglect the work on yourself so you can develop that clarity and that self-knowledge, so you can have the awareness to exert the right leverage at the right place at the right time. And that's essentially what I've been doing ever since in my various books and seminars. I do what I can, constantly looking for more effective ways to communicate, exercises, whatever it takes to help, to reach out to other people. There's a certain audacity in that. I often feel a little bit strange about it, Terry, because you know, if I were an auto mechanic and I was really good at that, it's understandable. I might write some books on how to fix cars. Or if I was a good dancer, I might write a book on dancing or yoga, you know, that sort of thing. But to write books about life and spirituality, wow, that's takes some chutzpah, I'll tell you. And sometimes people ask me, rightfully so, Dan, do you live, you know, have you mastered all the principles you talk about and write about in your books? And the answer is no, I have not. But I practice sincerely. I pay attention. I do my best. If someone observed me over time, they'd probably find me a good example of what I teach, not a perfect example. So I'm pretty straightforward in letting people know that I'm not here for people to trust me. That's not the point. I'm here to help people trust themselves in the process of their own life and their own practice. I would never tell a football player, you should really be better off, you know, doing Ashtanga yoga. Because if he loves football, that's what he should be doing. So we each have to find our own place in our process and reach out to people from where they are and not try to push people or assume we know what's best for them. So that's all I have to say for the moment.
That's great. Because you didn't respond to it, I'm wondering, do you perhaps not buy the idea that this is a unique time in history where something is ready to happen at a faster pace or in a different way? How do you relate to the idea that maybe we're in a special time where these processes are needing to accelerate?
Yeah, that reminds me of the person who went to the butcher and said, I want your best fish. And he looked and said, they're all best fish. And in a sense, of course it's a special, unique time now, but it's always been a unique time in different ways. Now, I'll grant you, history doesn't progress in a smooth line. There are these points, peaks and valleys, and it's time to take advantage of those. We certainly agree that the pace is accelerating. I said that at my first lecture on quote-unquote spiritual lecture I ever gave back probably 1984. I was teaching gymnastics prior to that, but then my interests expanded and the work I did. And in that, I said the pace is accelerating. And wow, it certainly is. Today we can all feel it. It's hard to keep up. You know, you get a new phone, there's a whole learning curve. You know, how to use it, technology, and I mean, people ask me these days, you know, Dan, what is enlightenment? I go, I don't know. Google it. Go to Wiki, because we haven't even caught up with the capacities of technology as tool, of communication, of information dissemination. We don't know how to handle it. There's just too much. So, of course, it's an amazing time to be alive. And maybe a sense of urgency with the environmental crises upon us. Our awareness is growing about all these things, the divisiveness today. So I don't think we necessarily evolve gradually. Sometimes we devolve for a while. Sometimes we stagnate or slip backwards, but I think it's really backing up for a running start. On the other hand, I'm not one of these true believers that says, you know, the Mayan calendar 2012, this is going to be the time. Because, you know, astrologically, that's just not supported. I don't think any particular planets are all lining up in 2012. I figure they'll find another date once 2012 rolls around.
Mm-hmm.
So the times are always special. The times are always intense. And in a way, it doesn't matter whether it was more or less in the past or will be in the future. We have this time. And the question is, what will each of us do to grow and to make a difference in our world? So that's to me, the most relevant question, rather than answering, you know, oh, yes, this is a special time and we need to do something right now.
So from your perspective, the universal and eternal reasons for becoming more conscious and more integrated and more fully present in life, as well as in a way that's transcending the plane of life. It's all about that which has always been the case, and responding to that fully and truly. In this moment, we encounter unique circumstances and challenges and even urgencies, but it isn't necessarily different than it was. Of course, it's different because it's always different, but there's nothing that it has a greater difference or a special or unique, nothing that you see that would be the basis for an acceleration of transformation or the convening of a new kind of cultural synthesis.
You know, I don't know, Terry. I really don't know. I could probably make an argument for either side of that, and I made a statement that the times have always been this way. It's always the best of times, the worst of times, in the words of Dickens and opening of Tale of Two Cities, you know, that has a universal quality about it. I just read that old, remember that old thing, Desiderata, which was on posters up in the 60s on everybody's wall, dorm wall? That still applies beautifully. So certain universals still apply. We're still human beings. We haven't evolved that much in centuries or even millennia in some ways. Just our abilities, but maybe not our consciousness. Well, that's not entirely true. There are things that are unacceptable today that we accepted before, like slavery, that are less and less acceptable. So we are waking up to certain higher...
Women have only been treated as equals to men. There are people who are alive today who were born at a time when women didn't even have the right to vote.
Well, that's another important example, and it's still true in most of the world that women are not treated as equals, which is, to me, just unfathomable. But
to me, that's a sign that there is an evolution of consciousness and culture that's important, even though there are eternal principles and eternal dynamics.
Well, you know, Kurzweil and other people who are futurists are talking about the parabolic curve that's happening in the development of computer chips and speed. We may be able to map the genome soon and within a decade or two and map consciousness in the brain. And who knows whether we transfer consciousness into silicon-based beings rather than carbon-based. Maybe that's part of our future. It's a bizarre idea. But I one thing Bill Gates said in his book, The Road Ahead, was one thing about the future: it's not predictable because there are too many variables involved. If 10,000 people make predictions, a few of them will end up being right, but nobody can unerringly say what's going to happen or what's coming.
Exactly. I like Yogi Berra's comment. He says,
yep.
It's hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
Exactly. About the past, it's a bit easier. Yes, it is a special time. It's obviously different in terms of our capacities to communicate now across the world. There was years ago, about 25 years ago, we started sponsoring a little boy in Africa, you know, that it was called Foster Parents and Planned Parenthood, not Planned Parenthood, Plan America. And it was through a program we started, and he would write through a translator. Someone would send little pictures he drew and letters. We couldn't speak English, and we couldn't really communicate much directly. That was probably 25 years ago. Today, he and I email all the time, and we talked on the phone the other day via Skype. So certain things in our own personal lives and in larger society are clearly accelerating, different than they've ever been before. So I would not ever just say, oh, it's all the same. And I think this is a quickening. And what happens really depends on the individual. I don't think it's going to be necessarily decisions made at a mass level, though that could happen too. I think deep down, many people come to me and say, Dan, I'm interested in spiritual life. I just woke up, I read your book, I read another book, and something happened, and now I'm so interested in all this. They don't even have a word for it yet. And they say, I'm interested in personal growth, psychological growth, spiritual growth. But many people in their heart of hearts are really saying, they're reaching out, they're saying, I want to find a way to feel good more of the time and to feel bad less of the time. As you know, Terry, suffering is the first grace when we realize that despite our successes, as Ram Dass once said, you know, when you don't get what you want, you suffer or you're disappointed. When you get what you don't want, you suffer. And even if you get exactly what you want, you still suffer because we can't hold on to anything forever in this world. So that recognition sends people not just looking for a new car, which is fine, or a new house, or a better job, or more money, or more travel, or whatever they think will make them happier. They start to say, there must be something I can do about the way I look at the world, my perceptual filters, my understanding. Many of us are caught up like at the foot of a mountain, and we're crawling through the weeds, looking at the little bugs and the dirt on the ground, and that's our view of life. We're wrapped up in this thing so close up. But something happens, a spiritual teacher, a book, an influence, and we find ourselves transported up that mountain, maybe to the top, maybe a ways up, and we look back and we see the larger picture. Everything looks more beautiful from a distance, and we get that bigger picture sense that it's okay, we're no longer stuck down in the weeds, and that is maybe one image of our spiritual journey, that ability to live fully in the conventional world, but also to recognize the transcendental truths that really inform this okayness, this sense of it's all unfolding as it should. And that's a part of what I think we're all doing here, and maybe why some of your listeners are tuned into the teleseminar.
Mm. Well, you know, I think that I appreciate everything you're saying. I mean, there's great sanity and common sense, which is what I always feel you're the kind of the fierce voice for in this contemporary spiritual conversation. There's a kind of grounded, healthy common sense that always comes through everything that you bring to the conversation. And yet, you know, I'm seeing certain dynamics right now. For instance, our listeners who've been tuned in to all the sessions heard an interview I did with Ken Wilber right at the beginning, where Ken describe the different stages of unfolding structures of consciousness that have unfolded over past history, how the archaic consciousness gave way to a tribal consciousness and a warrior consciousness and a traditional consciousness and modern consciousness and even postmodern consciousness, and that we're on the verge of a shift into perhaps another level that he calls integral. And that when about 10% of the population reaches a new stage of consciousness, there's a real shift, just as there was in the 60s when the postmodern consciousness really began to happen. But even more profoundly, around the time of the American Revolution, when modernity kind of took the wheel of the ship of state. And perhaps there could be such a transition now. And as I see problems, global problems like terrorism and global warming and other environmental issues that really can't be addressed very well by nation states, and you see so many people, the spirituality really is more
broadly taken seriously as a mystical path of transformation by much, much larger percentages of the populations of educated and relatively wealthy countries these days, it seems to me that we could reach some kinds of critical mass that could change things.
That would be great.
And I feel a certain responsibility to try to make something like that happen when I see circumstances around me kind of crying out to be addressed. And I always feel a certain tension because I think part of where what you've offered here kind of cautions against getting inflated, you know, getting grandiose. There is a tendency, particularly in postmodern culture, to be saying, you know, this is a unique time, this is so special, and in a way to get drawn into the story of our specialness and our importance and so forth. And yet, I guess I feel a moral responsibility to take seriously what do appear to be kind of unique design requirements that have appeared in our time, and to try to bring leadership to that. And, you know, I think you've been a leader and really given a lot to an awful lot of people. But it's there's kind of a question of, do we have a sense of possibility, and what would that possibility be like? One of the ideas that's percolated through what some of the earlier conversations I've had in this series was the idea that, you know, perhaps there's beginning to be something of we called it a meta-sangha, that is, a sangha of sanghas, or a connectedness in which some fundamental agreements might unite an awful lot of people of goodwill and sensitivity, such that they could be a moral force in a different way. What do you think of all that?
You mentioned Ken and his model of evolution of consciousness. And I think models are quite useful to bring people, give them some clarity, some focus, a lens, a platform on which to stand in the chaos of experience. I studied many different models over the decades myself, levels of consciousness in the individual and how we change and evolve. And these are all interesting things to think about and consider and give some, as I said, some focus and reference points. But it still comes down to each of us wakes up in the morning and we go to school or work. We live moment to moment during the day, and then we sleep, and then another day comes. So it has to be grounded out in everyday life. Otherwise, it becomes just a hobby of ideas and a mental exercise, which is fine for many people who really have that, you know, that jnani approach. And you certainly know that term. To understand these models of reality. And that's why people like Ken Wilber and others, yourself included, present these larger models. So I think that's quite useful. And, you know, one light, many lamps. Now, in terms of this idea of balance and coming down to earth, these have become cliches, and I don't want to repeat too many, but they've also been around because they're worth repeating. You've heard, of course, you're familiar with that old Arabic saying, trust in God, but tie your camel. In other words, we can have faith in life unfolding as it is, but also do what we can to help in a practical way. And many of us are moved to do that. I think for me, the shift happened. I was really into self-improvement when I was a young man, working on myself all the time, in gymnastics, you know, on my physical strength and body, and studying hard and learning what I could. But one day it just hit me that no matter how much I improved myself, only one person benefited. But if I could reach out to other people, that made my life more meaningful, if I could influence other people. So those of us who have taken on writing books, teaching, we seem called to do that. It's just part of our makeup. So, again, there's another saying, pray as if everything depended on God and work as if everything depended on you. That comes back to that balance again. What do we do in daily life? While we're talking about elegant ideas and models and shifts of consciousness, when someone talks to me a lot about mental ideas, and which I think are great, I sometimes say, hey, how's your relationship doing these days? And how's work going? And what service do you provide? Bring it back to earth for each of us, because not everyone either understands or gravitates toward larger models. It's like, what can I do in my life to make things work better. And that's what I've tried to respond to in my various books, each one a different facet of an approach to living. Terry, you might get a kick out of this. I've had a couple people come up to me saying, Dan, your book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, you know, really started me on my spiritual journey. It was a great way to start for beginners. But, of course, now I'm into more advanced spirituality. You know, I go, oh, you mean like things you don't quite understand? They say, yeah, now I'm reading books I don't understand. See, it's more advanced. So I sort of get a kick out of that. So I guess if it's clear, it must be for beginners only. But that's I guess.
Well, I mean, you offered a little tidbit there. Pray as if everything depended on God, and work as if everything depended on you. That one could spend a long time exploring what it takes to have the kind of open heart and faith and power of invocation of grace that really redeems that praying as if everything depends on God, and that kind of 100% personal responsibility that still doesn't go to a world in which there is no grace, doesn't close out that other dimension, but is cheerfully willing to be 100% responsible for generating everything that's required. That's a profound kind of learning that people may take decades to fully instantiate in every dimension of their lives. And I think a lot of what you offer as teachings have that kind of profundity. This idea that there are advanced and beginner teachings, I challenge that. I think that the more advanced we get, the more profoundly innocently we can give ourselves over completely to the beginner practice, which never goes away.
And that is so true. And I know you're speaking from your own direct experience here too, Terry, and online. In what you just said, I certainly would have to agree. It'd be fun to disagree on some things because, you know, that saying, if we agree on everything, only one of us is necessary. But I think we're pretty resonant in our understanding of some of these issues, as are your listeners. In fact, a woman came to me once, actually it's happened more than once, and usually it's women, sometimes men, and they say things like, you know, I wish my husband were into this kind of thing. I wish I could get him to the seminar. And sometimes, just in a humorous way, I will say, hold on, let me just kind of take a look at the Akashic record here. And I close my eyes, pretend I'm turning pages, you know, and just for fun. And then I look and say, oh, I just looked up your husband. Do you know he is such an advanced soul, he gets to take this lifetime off. He gets to just watch football and drink beer this lifetime. Because he's just so advanced. So, of course, the point I'm making is it's very difficult to know who is advanced and who is not. Some people know the terms, the jargon, Eastern, from one discipline or another, and they sound so spiritual and sophisticated. But it's like, how are their lives going? What is their example? What are they teaching through their own life? What service are they providing? How kind are they in their relations? That is I think, what a lot of it comes down to.
Well, one of the things that that has been present in some of the discourses we've had in this series, and certainly part of the larger spiritual conversation, it would be the kind of other point of view that might come to bear on what, in response to what you're saying, is that, okay, that's true, and bringing everything down to that ordinary level of life is absolutely necessary, but to make the ordinary level the test and the focus of attention can distract us from depth and profundity. And you know as well as I do that a real spiritually enlightened awakener with a radical non-dual consciousness who's brought that realization into the whole body is a fire and a profundity that is more than just succeeding at ordinary tasks in a kind of common sense way. There is such a thing as profundity that is a presence that is transformative and powerful. And let's not delete that from our vocabulary. Let's have a conversation that is both grounded in this wonderful ordinary way that you're helping us ground. But how do you make room for that depth? And how does that whole matter
part of what I'm trying to ask in this series, Dan, is this question of how things are changing right now, like teacher-student relationships. You and I went to a teacher who demanded submission and surrender in the most traditional kinds of ways years ago, and you don't demand that of people who come to you to teach.
No.
And it's cleaner and clearer, in many ways superior. But you don't become an all-consuming source for them, and the kinds of transformation that most of them realize, you know, without that fuller devotion, is there a limit to what they can get? And is there an evolution now going on in teacher-student relationships? And are the ways that you're relating to people maybe a sign of a different moment in cultural history? And is there something else that might be evolving? How might that be appearing?
I think many people have that question that you've just articulated. How can I find the right teacher? How can I have an experience, a retreat? What do I have to do to finally make that breakthrough? And certainly there's something to say for immersion, for complete stepping away from the world for a time on retreat, to step off the world and completely immerse. However, that may not be as practical for most people to do. So the way I've chosen to teach, the emphasis that I place, not the only way, there are so many ways, but is to spiritualize the ordinary, is to remember God or spirit in doing the ordinary things. And, you know, it's been called karma yoga. It's not no new invention of mine. So it's cutting off that division, that chasm between ordinary life and then spiritual life. It is integrative, actually. Living in a spiritual way with that consciousness, that non-dual, accepting, surrendering consciousness, in the midst of daily life. That's what interests me personally, rather than looking for the right retreat or guru or ashram to get away from the world. Because you know what? It's pretty easy to be spiritual when you're in a loving community where all you do is get up and meditate and eat your meals they're served and then go meditate some more and do some walking meditation and work in the garden. That's very nice. But what happens when you come back to your daily life, to raising families, to responsibilities? You know, I'm pretty excited, as I haven't been in a long time, actually, about a new book coming out in the spring, The Four Purposes of Life, Finding Meaning and Direction in a Changing World. I think it's going to address some of these issues. But for now, let me just say I'd like to define faith as I see it, F-A-I-T-H. To me, faith is the courage to live as if everything that happens is for our highest good and learning. And I'm going to repeat that because people sometimes go, wait, what did you say exactly? Notice there was nothing about belief in there, having to believe in something. Faith is the courage to live as if, everything that happens is for our highest good and learning. That is not easy to do. But when someone says, thy will be done, well, that means they're willing to accept all form of catastrophe as well, if they really are in that position. So to me, the street to the city are our ashram. There's that saying, when you can love hell, you'll be in heaven. And when we can bring spirituality and that consciousness into everyday life, we've really got something. But if it's just happening more when we do sit in a corner and do our spiritual exercises, like going to church just on Sundays and, you know, sinning the rest of the week, So I do hold to that. And of course, that you point out very well that complete commitment and immersion has its uses. But we also experienced that, and we saw some of the problems associated with it as well. So that's why I think combining East and West and spirituality and flesh into some kind of whole where it takes place in the world, to me that has some profound benefits, and it's actually a harder path than going off to an ashram and doing a lot of meditation and immersive exercises.
Yeah,
though there's a place.
If it's
that.
Understood with that same profundity, with the kind of profundity that you're expressing when you when you articulate that, I think. And it actually leaves me wondering, I mean, I hope you don't mind me asking, but one of the ways that I bring this alive in my own experience and with others is to talk about the cutting edge, and no matter where we are in our life or our practice, there are lessons we're currently learning or practices that we're having to remember to do each day. And I wondered if you'd be willing to talk, you know, from your own experience about where those edges are, because I think you, in many ways, live a lovely, exemplary life, you know. On the other hand, as someone who's growing and who's not perfected, you are working at an edge, too, and the places where you're challenging yourself or places where you're noticing new possibilities for new ways to be a warrior, new ways to be peaceful, new ways to be loving, new ways to be present, new ways to be awake. How does it show up? Maybe some stories would help everyone.
Yeah, it's all about, again, that finding ways to exert the right leverage in my role. When I'm playing the role of teacher, when I'm before a group of people or answering emails, in fact, I was going to share a couple of emails I answered just today as a pointed example of this the confusion that can happen around this whole spiritual journey. So in my life, you know, I mean, I sometimes joke and say at my age, people ask me if I exercise, for example, every day, and I get up first thing in the morning and I run to the bathroom. but after that, I do, you know, some conscious exercise to balance the body and eat a healthful breakfast and go about my day doing what I need to do. I mean, that's what... There are simple disciplines. You know, people sometimes say, I'm looking for more spirituality. I've got a spiritual problem. I have an emotional problem. I have a psychological issue I'm dealing with. And I ask most everybody three questions, and they're pretty simple. First, are you doing regular, moderate exercise? Second, are you eating a balanced diet? And third, are you getting enough rest? Now, that may not sound very spiritual, and it may not be the answer to everything, but I'll tell you, people work from that foundation. If they're doing regular moderate exercise, stretch the body, breathe deeply, move, get some vitality going, whatever is suitable to them, and if they're eating a balanced diet. Notice I didn't say vegetarian, vegan, all raw, in season, slow food, grown locally, macrobiotic, and you know all that. I just said find a balanced diet for you and get enough rest, and you have to find out what that means in each individual case. It took me many years to realize there is no best teacher, religion, exercise system, book, dietary approach. There's only the best for a given individual at a given time. So we never are absolved of the responsibility to recognize that life is an experiment, and we have to find out what works for us. Some people gravitate more to larger models and concepts. That helps them make a breakthrough and realize some things at a deeper level about the nature of their lives. Other people, it's through devotion, as you know. That's why there are all the different yogas. Nothing works for everyone. So keeping it grounded, I think, is important. But if you'd like to hear something very practical, I believe... There are two major issues in life that I see, Terry. One can take place at the individual or the global level even, certainly national level. And the other is a more individual matter. And whatever we talk about, spirituality or ideas, it still comes down to this. I think the biggest problem in the world today, and you know, people might be listening and going, okay, are you going to talk about... famine, plagues, are you going to talk about food, hunger? What's the biggest problem? I think the biggest problem is competitive mind. Competitive mind comes from a state of ego-based fear of being a separate somebody that has to overcome others. It's based on the core idea of separation. And let me give a very practical example of what I mean by competitive mind. Everyone knows about the game of tennis. We've either played it or seen it played. We know what tennis is. Tennis is quite a competitive game. The object of tennis is to make the person across the net from you fail. If they fail to return the ball, then you win the point. Quite a competitive game. When I play tennis, I play as well as I can. I hit the most skillful shots I can. But there is no competitive mind in me. It's completely collaborative because I recognize that person across the net is my teacher and my student. They're going to, how can I improve and get better unless they stretch me, unless they make demands for the way they hit the ball? Otherwise, I might as well hit it against a wall. So they are actually serving as my teacher. Whether or not that's their intention, I honor them and appreciate them as my teacher while I'm playing the best I can. They're also my student because I'm going to be doing the same for them. So even while I appear to be competing in the game of tennis, there is no sense of wanting to beat someone. You see, my goal has never been winning. I was a world champion athlete, but I've never had an aim to win because we can't control whether we win. There's no way to control. We can just do the best we can, but we don't know what someone else is going to do. And I've never aimed for success because I can't control whether I succeed. By making, a good effort, I increase the odds of that. So effort, in a way, is success because that's all I can control, my effort. I've only aimed for excellence in the moment. So while I'm playing that competitive game, there's no competitive mind. And look at today, Terry. Look at the divisiveness. We're rubbing our nose in partisanship and mean. I mean, look at the ads for the elections. All we knew was negative things about all the candidates. One would say negative things about the other, and they'd find it works. That's why they keep doing it. So it makes us cynical and frustrated as an electorate. Instead of people, wow, wouldn't it be refreshing if someone just said, well, this is why I'd like to serve as your whatever, because I have these qualities and I hope you'll vote for me. Wouldn't that be refreshing? But their handlers tell them, no, that won't work. You've got to take down your opponent. This whole competitive mind, it works at national politics. It works worldwide. One nation, lines on a map, competing against another nation. And we think it stimulates excellence. Well, there may be some level of that. But I think when we make the shift between competitive to collaborative mind, when we realize we're in this together, that's when I think this world will make a major change. And it may not sound really spiritual, but it is profoundly spiritual because we get more of a sense of oneness.
Beautiful. I couldn't agree more. In fact, we've even broached this topic in some of the previous interviews. I asked the question, how can cooperation compete? Which is a kind of interesting because in some ways we have marketplaces and environments where a kind of competition operates, but can a higher level of collaboration, a higher level of cooperation be a non-zero-sum quantity that is so effective that it supersedes the competitive mind you're talking about? And it seems to me that in some ways that already happens, and maybe there are going to be some new ways where we discover new ways to bring about a kind of competitive advantage to collaborative mind. What do you think of that?
Well, that's an interesting idea. It's good. It's a good play of ideas in terms of the ideas of competition and collaboration. I think we recognize our human connection and that on a level we are one, that others' success is our success. We can actually take sincere joy in somebody else's success and feel sorrow in their failure if they have a difficult time recognizing that connection. Otherwise, it's just an idea, a nice idea. Oh, let's not compete as much, let's collaborate. But let's say two people are vying for a job. That isn't that a competitive situation? Can you imagine one of the people coming out of the interview telling the other person going in for the interview, listen, I found it would be real helpful. I wish I'd said more about this. I want to offer that advice to you because it might help you. Can you imagine that? Wow. But unless they recognize their oneness and the play of life and aren't so desperate and in fear of, I've got to get this job and I hope this guy screws up, well, it's just a philosophy. So we do have a ways to go, but that's okay. We can raise these ideas and the possibilities of that we may shift more and actually in our behaviors more to a collaborative idea. And there are examples I could give, but let me also say that at an individual level, to all the talk about spirituality, the individual level, the biggest problem in the world, most of us will relate to, most of your listeners will, it's turning what we know into what we actually do. Because we are getting pretty sophisticated in our knowledge. For example, about regular exercise, balanced diet, enough rest, we're getting sophisticated on it's nicer to be kind to people, and so on and so forth, and different spiritual principles. But how do we turn all this knowledge into what we actually do in life? And, you know, like in terms of exercise, as you probably know, I've taught for years something called a Peaceful Warrior workout. It's like a Peaceful Warrior yoga routine, but it's designed to be completed in less than 4 minutes a day. And it's not the equivalent of working out in the gym for an hour and a half, pumping iron, or running 5 miles or doing an hour and a half yoga class. But it has balanced elements of all those, strength, supplement, stamina, and deep breathing, of course. And it's based on the principle a little of something is better than a lot of nothing. So keeping it simple, starting, you know, it's fine to dream big, but start small and connect the dots. And that is one key way to turn what we know into what we do, to start small and then connect the dots. Somebody wants to meditate regularly? Fine. Start 15 seconds a day, 30 seconds. Just sit for 30 seconds, breathing and being aware. And then maybe, you know, I usually do about 5 minutes, but I do it every single day, and I have a meditation that's sort of unusual that I've developed. But I do it for 5 minutes, but I do it every day. And to me, I get benefits that people who meditate for an hour or 20 minutes, you know, once in a while, maybe don't get. So integrating things into our daily lives in small doses is a way to begin to shift our lives, turn what we know into what we do. So that's
absolutely
a practical thing. And I think you point that out in your book, Integral Practice.
I do. I mean, one of the principles I'm teaching these days is the idea of moments. And one of the principles, you know, of Tibetan Dzogchen, high consciousness dharma, is to awaken and not to try to prolong it, because when you're trying to prolong it, you already have, you have the idea of what it is, but it's the fresh moment of discovery that is the magical moment. So just freshly resting as awareness for brief moments many times is the whole practice, like not even sitting in meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a profound thing. It works with gratitude. It works with even simplest kind of heart feeling and appreciation. It works with that to practice for a moment again and again and again, and to have that fresh beginner's mind that can discover a new moment of practice. It's such an important principle, and it's there in your books. I was just looking through No Ordinary Moments, which I think is a wonderful book, and you've really unpacked it, and I think you've taken seriously the task to do it in essentializing ways and eloquent ways. I'm curious what the new book is. You mentioned it. I know you're excited about it.
Yeah.
What's the basic idea of that you're working with there?
Well, many people feel a need to find a clearer sense of their purpose. Sometimes they're referring to their calling, their deepest calling. What am I here to do? You know, in the Peaceful Warrior movie, the screenwriter put in this line, which I didn't actually have in the book, but it's a wonderful line. You know, we've all heard it about it's the journey, not the destination, you know, that makes us happy. But yet, at the same time, without a destination, there is no journey. We're just wandering around. So Robert Byrne once said, the purpose of life is a life of purpose. So finding a purpose, and the problem with many people is they don't realize there are four fundamental purposes we're working with. Now, it's a little premature for me to start getting into those, but I have, as clear as I can communicate, I go into the four different kinds of purposes we're working with. But for now, we can address what you were referring to as a series of moments. Life is a series of moments, and I do teach that because it is realistic. I've never met a neurotic person, only people who have more neurotic moments. Sometimes they forget to be neurotic and they function quite well. I've had some intelligent moments. I've also had some stupid ones. So we're sometimes this, sometimes that. And grasping that moment when we can, that makes a difference. And even enlightenment, this is a more controversial idea. But I've never met an enlightened being. And, you know, you and I have been around some pretty heavy hitters. But I've only met people who have more enlightened moments. Now, some people have had an enlightenment or an illumination experience where they suddenly feel the oneness with all of humanity, where they see through the mind and break into peals of laughter. Those breakthrough moments, call them Kensho or Satori, whatever terms we want to use. And then what they want to do is repeat the experience, that profundity, because it tends to fade. The intensity of the initial experience fades. But it still informs our consciousness. So years later, we still feel it or remember it in a different way. But it's like athletes who've experienced being in the zone. They write to me and say, Dan, how can I be in the zone all the time? And I go, well, I wish I could tell you that, but you can maybe do it a little more moments of the zone. And we get into how they might increase those moments, but not all the time.
Mm.
If we were happy all the time, how would we know it?
It's rediscovering that happiness, rediscovering the zone, rediscovering our freedom in consciousness, rediscovering our grateful heart, rediscovering the generous impulse to serve, rediscovering our clarity. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's why we're doing this conversation. That's why you set up the teleseminar, to offer those reminders to people in whatever ways we can.
Yeah, beautiful.
And you know what? I think your listeners out there could offer us some useful reminders, too.
I'm sure they can.
Yeah.
Quite a few of them have been wonderful comments and blog entries and things on our Facebook page. We're at the point where it's time to invite people to join us in the conversation. And I know many of you have typed out some questions in the instant teleseminar window. We'll go to those soon.
Terry, let me interrupt for a moment because as a segue into that, and by the way, it's my favorite part. I would have been happy to respond to questions the entire time. I love doing this kind of thing, responding to living questions that people, heartfelt questions. But if I could start by just touching upon two emails I received today that point out.
I'd love to have you do that, Dan, but let's do that in just a moment. We have some sponsors I want to mention before
sure.
we go further, and then we'll be ready to do that. Let's do that.
Okay.
I want to let people know about Next Step Integral. Over the past 4 years, I've had the great pleasure of presenting at the Integral Education Seminars hosted by Next Step Integral. These events have been among the most heartwarming and transformative ones offered by the Integral community. And as an international nonprofit, Next Step Integral is involved in 5 fields of inquiry: education, parenting, ecology, young people, what they call Generation Next, and community, and specifically looking at how the integral visions and perspectives can be put into action. They do an excellent job of walking the talk. In the coming year, Next Step Integral will be sponsoring a number of groundbreaking events, including the first ever seminar on integral community, as well as co-sponsoring a mother-daughter retreat entitled Raising Empowered Radiant Daughters that's going to be taking place in July from the 24th to 30th. Of 2011 in Costa Rica, where Miriam Mason Martineau will be co-facilitating with Catherine Woodward Thomas and Jessica Romisher. You can email journeys at journeysofthespirit.com for more information on this retreat, and you can learn more about Next Step Integral and sign up for updates at nextstepintegral.org. And New Dimensions Media. Check out New Dimensions to hear some of the leading point writers in the world, such as Alice Walker, Dr. Andrew Weil, Jean Houston, Bill Moyers, and David White, as they address a wide range of topics, including health and healing, science, eco-activism, social change, and spirituality. Do it now, and you'll be glad you did. That's New Dimensions Media at newdimensions.org. newdimensions.org. And I want to also mention Dan's website, peacefulwarrior.com. Dan has authored, maybe my count is off, Dan, 13, 14 books total at this point.
Yeah.
There's a graphic novel of the Peaceful Warrior that's just appeared, and I highly recommend it, especially, it's fun for all of us, and it's
maybe a way to bring in a younger person into some of these considerations in a rich way. And you can see all kinds of resources at his website, peacefulwarrior.com, peacefulwarrior.com.
Thanks, Jerry.
So, yeah. Well, Dan, I want to invite you to go right ahead there with those emails that you thought were kind of interesting. Let's hear about those.
Terrific. Because we were talking about are major changes going on today, and I go back to I'm listening on tape to a rather long book called War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, and one of the characters, Pierre Bezukhov, after having dedicated himself to the higher ideals and virtues espoused in the Freemasons, this is in the early 1800s in Russia, he presents a manifesto of virtue and proposal to better society in the world as a whole through the Freemasons, much in the manner of that idealistic document presented by the movie protagonist Jerry Maguire to his sports agency firm. For those who saw that film, Pierre Bezukhov's proposal is met with much the same results. And this is what he says. At that meeting, he was struck for the first time by the endless variety of men's minds, which prevents the truth from ever presenting itself identically to two persons. Even those members who seemed to be on his side understood him in their own way, with limitations and alterations he could not agree to. As what he always wanted most was to convey his thought to others, just as he himself understood it. So I wanted to read that one part because it struck me, listening to Tolstoy in the early 1800s, this fellow who was seeking, again, more spiritual consciousness and to share it with others. And that's why I tell people my responsibility is not to convince others to my way of thinking, but only to express myself with sufficient clarity that others can agree or disagree based on understanding what I've said rather than on misunderstanding it. That's my responsibility, to be clear. So I received two emails today, and I hope this is going to be interesting. I think it will be. The first person, I'll just call M.H., she wrote, "I'm looking forward to hearing the presentation tonight on Beyond Awakening. I think Dan and my husband and I are on the same wavelength regarding his philosophy of life. We took an awareness and personal growth program in 2003 that brought us much in alignment with Dan's teachings. Dan states that the past and future don't exist. The present is what matters. I'd like to add to that, fate, pure chance, or coincidence for that matter do not exist either. If you apply his and our reasoning, since we create our own experience," stated my correspondent, that what we live through is the result of conscious or unconscious choices we make each day. I'm looking forward to hearing what he's got to say about this tonight. With much appreciation," then was signed. And so that was one email I received. What I wrote back was that it may be that we're on the same wavelength, or perhaps not. And that's why I read that quote from Tolstoy. But as the saying goes, if we agree on everything, only one of us is necessary. In my view, we are each and all entitled to our own faith and beliefs, but not entitled to our own facts. I do my best to base my statements on a close observation of how reality actually works, rather than on New Age philosophies or theories that I might have read in a book or heard at a seminar. I cannot be certain about what you mean precisely, that the fate or pure chance or coincidence do not exist. Perhaps there are no coincidences or accidents, only lessons at the transcendental level, but from the conventional level, chaos and coincidence may be also true and real. So anyway, I go on. I'm feeling right now that it may not serve your listeners for me to just read things, but I did answer that as best I could. And another email dealt with someone said, "I read your book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, and loved it. I found a lot of similarities with the teachings of Abraham. In your book, which teaches the law of attraction and alignment with your source and God. The secret misses out on that latter part," they wrote. "I was surprised to see your view of metaphysics on your Facebook page. Does this extend to the teachings of Abraham? Because it seemed to them that I was dismissing metaphysics for more, say, practical ventures." So I thanked them for writing, and I said, "Though I've heard about the well-known entity called Abraham, I have not studied these teachings, so I cannot comment on any specifics. Over the years, I've heard of many such metaphysical sources of channeled wisdom, whether or not they are truly channeled teachings. In my view, it would be ideal if all such so-called channeled teachings were presented as written transcripts without any kind of attribution or story behind them, to remove the fascination or woo-woo factor associated with such presumably discarnate beings. That way, any valuable perspectives or wisdom could be taken at face value without giving them extra credibility because of some sort of mysticism or otherworldly process involved. Let the words speak for themselves. It is either insightful and helpful, or it is not. And I said, I'm glad you enjoyed my first book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, which is really an introduction to my work, and have found resonance with the wisdom expressed therein. But it is not my wisdom, or even that of my old mentor, the man I call Socrates. It's the same timeless wisdom, the expanded or transcendent perspective shared by those of every time and place whose calling it is to share insights with others. In fact, and I want to share this with you and your listeners especially, it seems to me that all humanity's wisdom has been expressed and articulated long ago by the Taoist masters like Chuang Tzu, Lao Tzu, and the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, and the transcendentalist writers, and the wise of every culture. But each new generation benefits from fresh voices to articulate this perennial wisdom available to us all in ways that are understandable and relevant to modern men and women. And I'm just one of those voices, so I do believe that there is only one light, but there are many lamps. So anyway, that's how I responded, and thank you for letting me share those two emails as a segue into responding to listeners' questions and comments.
Terrific. Well, if you have called in on the phone and you have a question, we want to invite questions rather than commentaries, but please, you are very welcome. You can raise your hand by pressing *2 on your telephone. And I have a question that was written in via the webcast from Joan in Winnipeg. How do you deal with indecision or a lack of clear direction in your own life? If you surrender to the higher will and ask that the answer be in the best interest for all concerns and are open and so forth, how do you receive that answer and know that it's not coming from your own ego? And if an answer doesn't come, what does that mean?
Wow, what a great question. Let's say something first about the word ego, because ego gets a bad rap in spiritual circles. You know, if someone says you have a big ego, that's not normally considered a compliment. And, of course, we have some non-dualist teachers who talk about there's you, then there's the ego, which seems strange to me in a non-dual kind of philosophy, because, frankly, the ego is the conscious self. Its function is to learn, to absorb information. It's like a disposable contact lens. We don't need it when we die anymore, but it is our personality level, our identity. The problems happen only when we believe that's all we are, but it's certainly a functional way to organize experience. So I'm not here to get rid of my ego or to get rid of anybody else's. I'm here to help us transcend it through insight and humor. There's a difference between transcending the ego and getting rid of it. It's not a bad thing. It's functional as necessary. Otherwise, we're psychotic. We have no sense of self at all. So, again, transcending it is different from getting rid of it. I use my ego, my personality level, to teach, to learn, and to serve. I don't take this Dan Millman character that seriously, but it's a handy label. So in terms of worrying about whether it's your ego or your higher self or your soul, to me that's crazy-making. You know, thy will is your will. There's a spark in you, and I'm speaking to the questioner now, Joan. Joan, there is a spark in you and in each of us. The question is, to get past the confusion that we've been kind of dealt with when we grow up, we have to find the difference, for example, of what we think we should do or what others expect of us and what we really want to do. And that involves a necessary process of inspection because, you know, there's a period of life, Joan, I don't know what your age is, but there's a period of life we call the trying 20s. Because in our 20s, we try this, then we try that. That decade is to start to learn who we are. And it takes a while to do that. The more we know ourselves, the better and more wisely and fully informed our decisions may be. But if you're looking for a sense of certainty, just making a choice and knowing it's the right one, you know, there's a point at which we just make a choice and go for it and learn what lessons are contained in that. So In fact, I don't mean to make this kind of thing a commercial statement, but I have to tell you that in the four purposes of life, I go deeply into that very question of making decisions, how to bring our subconscious into our decision-making process so it's more fully informed. Because, you know, the left brain, our logical side can only weigh variables, you know, pros and cons, ins and outs, ups and downs. So in decision-making, self-knowledge comes first. Who am I? What are my talents? What are my values? What are my interests? When those lines intersect, that is a good guideline. So that's indecision and weighing variables is a part of life. But eventually we make a decision, and that's what you commit to. And that's what I could say for the sake of this conversation, and I hope that's responsive to the question.
That's great. Thanks, Dan. I think that's lovely. We have a question here from Joe Vic Celeste in Saranac Lake, New York. Go right ahead.
Hi, I don't know why you have my name messed up, but well, listening, I can.
Well, what is your name?
My name is Vicky.
Hi, Vicky.
Hi. Anyway, my question is, if we can boil this all down to, this has all been said before, and the enlightened people, everyone in the past who has had these enlightened thoughts and we have these same things, why can't we make a commitment that we're going to go beyond? Why do we need to say that this is all good, and it is, but why can't we say, let's step forward, let's think bigger. And I sort of feel that listening, I feel this lack of commitment. On one level, I hear we'd have to live in this dual existence, which is true. I have to pay my bills and I have to live in this world. But we have to also have that spiritual idea in our minds. But I feel like we have to say, let's all say that we're going to go forward and we want to evolve, and that we're going to keep going forward. But I don't want to keep going, but I just don't understand why we can't think that we will transcend beyond these ideas that we already understand.
Yeah, why can't we actually live these in a way that maybe hasn't been done before?
Right.
Cool. What do you think, Dan?
Well, I'd love to. I think Vicky might have some answers as well. I'd love to see if Vicky has any suggestions for how we might think bigger. I can suggest them on my own, but I have a feeling Vicky has some ideas about it too. How can we think bigger and live differently? What might you do, Vicky, in your own life, for example?
Well, I think that we have to we have to believe that we are doing this together, and I think that it will take not just, you know, living our own lives and trying to you know, reach our own greatest potential, but seeing this as something that we must do together. And
wow, I certainly agree with that. I mean, you know, many people are waiting to meet the guru on the mountaintop, but often it's just somebody, a fellow climber, reaching down with a helping hand, in the same way you or I can reach down and if someone's behind us, to help them up. That recognition that we are in this together, that's why, as you probably know, in the traditions, there's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which is the teacher, the community, and the teaching. All three are helpful. I have friends who have Dharma groups. They meet with friends once a week, and they meditate together and discuss these ideas. You know, they're writing groups who work with writing. Why not Dharma groups? So to reach out to others and start to remind one another about what's possible in life. Because I agree with you. I know it sounded like I'm just saying, let's just live our daily lives and, you know, and spiritualize as best we can. But that's what we're going to live anyway. Whatever our ideas are, we are going to live our daily lives. So meanwhile, if we always live with a sense of dilemma, but there's got to be more, I could be doing more. It's like people who say, I'm not reaching my potential yet. Well, maybe they have reached their potential. this sense of dilemma only reinforces, you know, the search only reinforces the sense of dilemma that sent us searching in the first place. So at the same time, I do emphasize, and I hope that wasn't too irritating to you, Vicki, just living our daily lives, being as kind as we can, thinking big, but, you know, starting small. To me, I found it very practical that people can actually access that. But if I start saying we have to think bigger, well, what does that mean? How can people do that? What I try to do at the same time as I try to stay practical is to remind people of the bigger picture of life. That this is the transcendental vision, that ultimately everything is unfolding as it should, no matter how it seems. We need to comfort each other and hold each other with that and give ourselves comfort in our sense of community. So I don't want to wander on, but I hope that at least in spirit or in tone responds to your question, and I'm glad you raised it.
Thank you. It does.
Thank you, Vicki. That was really great. We've got a question from Carmen in San Juan, I think it's in Puerto Rico. Dan, you said to look how balance is in the life of a spiritual teacher. But can't people sometimes help me even if they're not perfected? Do I need to know how balanced my doctor is and how his life is in order to let him guide me in my recovery from an illness?
Yeah, people often ask about teachers, and, you know, if I'm going to learn tennis, I want to find someone who's more experienced, or how to fix a radiator, I'm going to find someone who knows how to do that. So in the same way, there are people all around us. That saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears, what I think it means is when the student is really paying attention, the teacher appears everywhere. And I think that's what our questioner was really pointing to. We can learn, you know, there's an old proverb, an ancient proverb there, we have no friends, we have no enemies, we only have teachers. That when we pay attention, we can learn from the world of nature, observing streams flow downhill and trees bend in the wind. So, of course, we can learn from everybody around us. We ourselves are teachers, and we teach by our example. We can raise the standards or lower them by how we live day to day. People are watching us. So we are all students, all teachers. We're all in this together. I can't emphasize that enough. So I would certainly agree that we have to find our own way and find what works best for us. But our teachers are all around us. It's not a matter of just finding a guru like I described Socrates in the gas station or somebody in an ashram, but it's finding wisdom where we can. And we are in this together in that sense.
Great. There's a question from someone named Fikri, I think it's a man, in Sydney, Australia. Dan, I'm a small business owner, and I'm all for the practice of cooperation rather than competition, and even in the business environment. And I'd like to do something about it, but how do I promote this practice? And if rejected, how should I respond to that?
Well, I remember a simple thing that I was in an auto supply store once, and they said, well, we don't have what you want, but, you know, down the street there's another auto supply, and I think they probably have that. Now, I have no idea whether they're actually under the same management, but they seem to be two, quote-unquote, competing stores. So small gestures like that, saying, why don't you try this place? They sell what we sell. Wow, maybe that store, and say, tell them we said hello. Can you imagine going to the store saying, oh, Joe's down the street. They send me here. They said, you probably have what I need, and they send their regards. Small gestures like this can make a huge difference. In the green room before a TV interview one day, I met a man who wrote a book called Stop and Sell the Roses. And it was about doing business but he became a social worker. He started National Flowers, and then he became a social worker. And so he wanted a more humanistic way to do business. And there are certain people, John Mackey and others, Whole Foods, that try to bring in these new ideas about collaboration rather than the old models what do you want to look back on in your life, how you behave to other people. So even if you make a few extra sales being highly competitive, making small gestures can make a huge difference in terms of connecting people. But practically speaking, conventionally speaking, yes, there are businesses that compete for different people's business. I know that, just like tennis is a competitive game. But we can shift the way we look at it. And remember, well, I had a friend who was an insurance salesman, stockbroker, and financial planner. But he was one of the most spiritual guys I know. he just used his work as an excuse to connect with people. And he took great joy in his work. Sometimes they did business, sometimes they didn't. That's another way to, rather than cling desperately to winning the game and getting the business, is to just connect with people and see what happens from there. It may work out very well on many levels.
Thank you, Dan. We're going just a little over our original intended time. Is that okay with you? Could we take one more question before?
Sure, I hate abrupt endings like that, yeah.
Terrific. There's somebody calling from Winter Park, Florida, and you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. My name is Joy, and I'm thrilled to have rediscovered you again, Dan. I, of course, was familiar with several of your books in the 90s, and now I've had the occasion to hear you twice in a week. I really loved you with Jennifer McLean earlier. And it's been a fascinating thing to listen to you because it's like you are saying out loud my own knowing. So it's been quite a thrill inside of me. My question to you is that for the last 5 years, I've been writing about this myself, but it's all in handwritten, spiral-bound notebooks. And I really do focus on managing the moment. And when I seem to feel stuck, I'm wondering if you could help me take baby steps towards how one would start now to deliver a message, to share what I've written. I see all sorts of things come up inside of me, and I feel that I'm in my own way. And I'm wondering if you could say anything about how I could get out of my own way.
Well, Joy, how lovely to hear from you, and it's what a perfect question. And I'm happy to respond to that. Boy, I'm glad you could tolerate listening to me twice in a week. That's amazing. Speaks to your endurance and patience. But the fact that you've done some writing and are moved to share with others, I think is just terrific. And the best answer I can give to you is this. If you go to my website, peacefulwarrior.com, where it says contact, just drop me a quick note, just even in the subject line, say, please send writing information. I have a couple pages prepared of observations, practical observations and suggestions for someone who's an aspiring author who's done some writing. And that way I could give you a much better answer through email. I'd be happy to send that off to you or anybody who's interested in writing and would like to compose a book. So that's all you have to do. And I'll send you some, I think, practical information. And if you have any questions after that, you can just drop us a note too.
Thank you. I will enjoy doing that. One last little piece, because I'm sure other people deal with this as well. What have you found as an effective way to overcome fear if you want to do something and you're afraid?
Well, that's one of the quote-unquote specialty areas. Obviously, I teach the Peaceful Warrior's Way, and we definitely address in almost all my seminars and retreats the issue of fear, and because it comes up in daily life, not just terror, but it comes up as self-doubt, anxiety, all kinds of different forms. And fear is a wonderful servant, but it's a terrible master. So I'd like to just remind you of this. Dealing with fear, Joy, is not about getting rid of it. It's not about finding a way not to feel fear. In fact, it's impossible to show courage unless you're feeling afraid. One of my favorite quotations by Costamato, he's a famous boxing coach, he said, heroes and cowards feel exactly the same fear. They just respond differently. So the only suggestion I would give you is to accept your fear as natural to you in the moment whenever it comes up, but then question, fine, I feel afraid, but what am I going to do? Now, there's much more to it. That's why I take people through various experiences and so on. We go more in depth, obviously, in a seminar situation. But I hope that at least responds. It's not about not having the fear. It's perfectly natural sometimes. But what will you do? How will you respond? That's the question, and that's where the courage comes in.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. That was great. We have gone a little over, so before I tell everybody what's coming up next week and before we all open up the line so we can hear many of our voices and say goodbye, a few reminders. If you're interested to dive deeper in the conversation, please be sure to visit our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog and also join our Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook, where you can discuss any of the topics we talked about today. And you can also find some forums that have particular threads of discussion, and you're invited to post comments about today's dialogue and also your suggestions and questions for Thursday's dialogue with Samuel Bonder and Linda Groves Bonder, spiritual teachers, and Samuel's the founder of the School of Psycho-Spiritual Whole Being Integration called Waking Down in Mutuality. And then a week from today, I'll be having a conversation with integral philosopher Steve McIntosh. So if you or anybody you know might be interested to join the series, if you're not already signed up, please register at beyondawakeningseries.com, or you can forward any of our emails to someone else and they can join us that way. If you're interested to learn more about me, Terry Patton, and my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And I want to thank a couple of other partners and sponsors, especially Ray Lynch Productions. A number of you have asked me about the hold music we play just before the call begins. It's a piece called Only an Enjoyment from the album by Ray Lynch with the provocative title, Nothing Above My Shoulders But the Evening Sky. His album Deep Breakfast went platinum without him performing or touring, just based on the depth and beauty of the sounds. His conscious music offers timeless beauty that doesn't grow old. You can purchase it at raylynch.com or via iTunes. That's raylynch.com. And BeliefNet. Did you know that BeliefNet.com exists to help people like you find and walk a spiritual path that brings comfort, hope, clarity, strength, and happiness? As the largest spiritual website, not only does BeliefNet offer inspiring devotional tools, access to the best spiritual teachers and clergy in the world, and thought-provoking commentaries, you'll also experience the most supportive online community around. If you're looking for daily support, sign up now, and any BeliefNet newsletter will be sent to you daily with a dose of wisdom, humor, inspiration, and more. Just visit BeliefNet.com today. The title of my conversation on Thursday with Samuel and Linda Bonder is Becoming a Human Son. It will probe into the possibilities of awakening quickly and directly in the midst of our daily lives without waiting to perfect ourselves, and how that can transform our service to others. And next Sunday, a week from today, when I talk with philosopher Steve McIntosh, we'll be engaging. He's the author of a book called Integral Consciousness and the Future of Evolution, and he's just finished writing a major new book entitled Evolution's Purpose, an Integral Interpretation of the Scientific Story of Our Origins. So we'll bring his philosophical brilliance to bear on the questions we've been raising in this series. So thank you, everybody, so much for joining me, and thank you so much, Dan. Let's open up our phone lines now so that everybody can hear each other's voices and we can all say goodbye.
Namaste.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Love you, Dan.
Thank you.
Bye, Dan.
Thank you, Dan Millman. Brilliant.
We love you.
Dan.
My pleasure. Love you,
wonderful.
Too.
All right. Wonderful. Thanks. Thank you, everybody. And thank you again, Dan. That was a lot of fun.
My pleasure, Terry.
Okay. I think we've turned off the recording now, and we can get off the line.
Okay.
I'll give you a call here in a minute, Dan.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.